This is Ryan Johnson, the writer and director of Brick, and you are listening to Film Spotting.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Tasha Robinson.
This is The Oasis. A whole virtual universe. You can do anything, be anyone, without going anywhere at all.
Do you think there's a part of the Oasis where you just kind of hang out and talk about movies?
Yeah, but, you know, as we see in the film, you get to do it with Batman.
Oh, Adam, I really don't like the way this metaphor plays out over the course of this film.
Nicely done. That's Tasha playing Batman, and that's a clip describing the immersive virtual world in Steven Spielberg's Ready Player One. This week on the show, our review, along with our top five movie homages. That and more.
Yeah, so much more. We're going to need a bigger studio.
Ahead on Film Spotting. Welcome to Film Spotting. In for Josh this week, Tasha Robinson from TheVerge.com and the Next Picture Show podcast. It's been a little while. I've seen you once or twice at some screenings recently, but we haven't really had a chance to chat since that big two-part top 10 films of 2017 roundtable back in December. Actually, I think it just finished taping about 5 minutes ago.
I'm still recovering from that. It was a long 12 hours of taping.
It was, but hopefully a fruitful 12 hours of taping. We certainly did have a good time, and it's great to have you back. How have you been?
Oh, I've been great. I always look for you in screenings and then sit directly behind you and throw popcorn at the back of your neck during the scary parts
of
the
movie. It's you, isn't it?
It is me.
Yeah. Well, we are going to play Film Spotting Madness here in a little bit, get some of Tasha's thoughts on the Final Four and those results. We did, of course, have a couple NCAA March Madness winners decided earlier this week. We'll give our congrats to Notre Dame women and the Villanova men, but we will have the winners of our Final Four coming up here. We'll announce the championship matchup for the Best of the 90s crown, Pulp Fiction versus Silence of the Lambs and Goodfellas versus Fargo. This, I will tell you, we actually have a legitimate upset. Tasha, have you been following along with any of this Film Spotting Madness goofiness?
I have, and I love the mechanical nature of it with the voting, because I know exactly what percentage of your listeners I'm going to offend when I say, Schindler's List over the Iron Giant?
Right.
What were you people thinking? There are a lot there are a lot of places here where I didn't exactly vote with the majority, but it's certainly been interesting to watch.
Mm. Later in the show, we will have as well our top five movie homages, and we'll get into what all of that means. Basically, references to movies like the ones we get in Ready Player One and some that are unlike all of the ones we get in Ready Player One. That top five and more coming in a bit. But first, Steven Spielberg's Ready Player One is set in a virtual reality game world populated by, among other things, images from other Steven Spielberg movies. Let's get to our review, and let's do it in the form of homages to our own most iconic reviews.
My name's Wade Watts. My dad picked that name because it sounded like a superhero's alter ego, like Peter Parker or Bruce Banner. But he died when I was a kid, my mom too. And I ended up here. Sitting here in my tiny corner of nowhere. There's nowhere left to go. Nowhere. Except the Oasis.
Ty Sheridan as Wade Watts there in that clip from the trailer for Ready Player One. His tiny corner of nowhere is Columbus, Ohio, 2045. In the Oasis, a virtual world created by Wade's hero, James Halliday, Wade is Parzival, on a quest to win the contest Halliday created prior to his death that grants the winner Halliday's own fortune and control of the Oasis. Now, despite having never read Ernest Cline's 2011 source material of the same name, I should be the target audience for Ready Player One. I mean, sure, short of some Super Mario Kart against the kids over the years, the last video game I played religiously was NHL 95 on Sega Genesis. I've never participated in a role-playing game or have an online avatar, save for the same picture of William Miller holding a microphone from Almost Famous I've been using for like 15 years. Why envision a badass fantasy version of yourself when you can be a dorkier, reality-based version of yourself? But I am a child of the 80s, weaned on Marty McFly and MTV and Missile Command for the Atari 2600, and the movies of Player One director Steven Spielberg. Indiana Jones was the first non-caped, non-spandex-clad, non-set a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away character I ever wanted to be, and E.T. was the first movie to ever make me cry while sitting in a movie theater. You'd think, with the intoxicating lure of the film's copious pop culture references, the timely class commentary we see in those exploited by an evil corporation led by Ben Mendelsohn's Nolan Sorrento, and the potential for a profound exploration of the dangers of technology and virtual reality, our willingness to sacrifice interpersonal contact and connection for escape, disengaging not just from each other but from the world we actually inhabit, there'd be a lot to latch onto. And yet, if I'm being honest, the most provocative moment in the movie for me was the first time Wade visits the virtual Halliday Library, where he can watch and rewind and fast forward through all of Halliday's defining professional and personal moments, his diaries programmed to life. I was fascinated by the implications of libraries like this actually existing, a pseudo-Eternal Sunshine scenario crossed with that 2014 Johnny Depp artificial intelligence movie nobody saw, and not just for brilliant icons like Halliday, but for everyday inconsequential folks like me. Spielberg and screenwriters Klein and Zach Penn, though, are arguably less concerned with such existential matters than they are adventure. Tasha, you're not just a child of the 80s, but I think I'm using the right nomenclature here. You're a tabletop gamer, a role-playing gamer. I mean, basically, you're a huge nerd.
I'm a huge nerd.
Okay.
I would also accept dork, but not dweeb.
Fair enough.
You're very important.
Noted. So how did Ready Player One resonate with you? Nimble, nostalgic reverie, smart sci-fi romp, or neither?
Do I have to give my response in the form of an alliterative allusion?
You do.
I have not scripted such a thing. I think I approached it less as a gamer or a child of the 80s is such a strange term because it literally conjures up an image to me of me gestating in an egg sac like the ones in Alien, except the egg is 80s culture.
Ah.
I don't think that's how it worked.
No, I don't think so.
But Ernest Cline, who wrote the book Ready Player One, which this is an adaptation of, that is also sort of how he seems to perceive the world, is what raised him was the culture of the 1980s. And the book is obsessed with the culture of the 1980s to the point where it seems to be the defining thing about this culture. I think I approached the movie more than anything else as an improvement on the book in a variety of ways. I really enjoyed the book the first time I read it, but I also thought it was a very slick, glossy, surfacey, like big ball of cotton candy without a lot there to chew. I think the movie does a lot with it that improves on it. And one of the bigger things, I think, is that it shifts away from this idea that the only interesting culture is the culture of the 1980s and that it has consumed everyone in 2045 and shifts it more to this is a preoccupation of certain very obsessive nerds who want to solve this puzzle and win this game. It's an obsession of some very specific people who look to it for the gain, the corporate and financial gain that it can give them. But it's not an all-encompassing thing. Other people in this world exist and they're doing other things.
Yeah. You don't really get that sense here at all.
No. I think you get it a lot more than
you
get
you
in
do.
The book. Yeah, for certain. And there are a lot of other relatively small shifts that I think make this a much more functional story. One of them being that Halliday is a very sad character.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of tragic that he's created a world where in order to survive, you have to subsist in his memories, in his past, in these things that obsessed him and kept him away from human contact. The degree to which he's a tragic figure and they're trying to understand why he feels he made the wrong choices, I think makes this a much more melancholy and human movie than it would be otherwise.
Okay. Yeah, that definitely comes through. Now, I haven't read the book, but I do get that in Mark Rylance's performance as Halliday, certainly.
He's so good. Mark Rylance is just so good in so many things. And of course, he and Spielberg, having teamed up previously on Bridge of Spies, he was such a standout role in that movie.
I think, though, I will just say real quick, what I was thinking of is how everybody we see in this movie, I can't think of anyone I don't see in this film who isn't either in the Oasis or we're watching them in their living room with the headset on. They seem to always be in the virtual reality, so I guess I'm making an assumption that they are equally obsessed as some of the characters, but maybe that's not the case.
I think they're maybe equally obsessed with other things.
Okay.
I think the fact that we get to see, for instance, Minecraft world and Doom world mm-hmm. and all of these other things is a suggestion that other people are preoccupied with different forms of culture.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's a little telling that they're still preoccupied with our culture, and there's no sense that anything new is being created
yeah.
in 2045. But that's sort of – well, we can get into the movie's flaws in a minute. I think first what I really want to emphasize is that leaving aside a lot of the big issues that people have had with this film, it's nostalgia, it's sort of shallow worship of a bunch of pop culture indicators, and some really lazy character writing and character dynamics, this is a really fun movie. I absolutely enjoyed the visual dynamism of it, the fast-moving, exciting set pieces, the way it takes up certain signifiers that I'm very fond of, some of which are not 80s references, and plays with them. I think that this is a very playful movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very energetic movie. And it was a really exciting movie to be in if you didn't expect too much character depth or thought from it.
Yeah, and maybe that was partly my problem. But I did have a lot of fun with this movie, too, up until a certain point. And I can pinpoint it. And this is probably a subjective thing for everyone watching this film. Some people maybe were completely entranced by it the whole time. But for me, I felt the moment when it seemed as if Spielberg just needed to get everything in, all of the plot and all of the character development. Everything had to come together, and he had to do it fast enough to fit it into this running time, which is 2 hours and 20 minutes the way it is. And it's the moment after, I'll just say, they get the second key. They're on this quest. I won't give away any of the details of it. It might sort of be a spoiler. There is a huge cinematic reference at the core of this. And after that scene, I felt as if all the time and the care that the movie had taken in setting up the characters, in setting up the rules, it then just got abandoned. And the plot kicked in. And all of a sudden, characters who we've only seen in the Oasis now are introduced. We don't really understand where they came from or why or how. The movie doesn't want us to think about those things. And there are lots of examples I could give of that type of dynamic at play where you said it, actually, in your review over at TheVerge.com. We'll link to it in our show notes as well at filmspotting.net. A very thorough, a very well-written review, of course, as always, but also a fair one in that you highlight the things you enjoyed about it, but you do point out some of those flaws. And you say that the film version does carry over some of the book's most notable flaws, especially a suspicious reliance on narrative convenience and coincidence. The characters are thinly drawn. I felt that. I felt that coincidence. I felt that convenience. And there's even a scene that occurs between Mendelsohn's bad guy and his kind of henchwoman. Her name is Finale in the film. And there's a scene that seems completely disconnected from the rest of the movie where she's yelling at him and they're having this kind of confrontation that really does not make any sense without other scenes around it that set up what their dynamic is and really why we should care about them even talking to each other in this moment. It felt a little haphazard and chaotic and random, that last third of this film for me.
This is one of those movies where I really wonder if the eventual home video release will be 4 hours long. Because there are a great deal of plot hooks here that feel like more could be hanging from them and possibly like more was intended to be hanging from them. And one of the biggest things is when our hero, she says somewhat sarcastically, moves out of the Oasis and meets some of these people in real life, there is so much opportunity there. There's so much that could be said about the contrast between how people present themselves mm-hmm. online and what they are in real life. And none of these people are what they were presenting themselves as. And that is an interesting thing. But the movie cannot take a breath to address it or consider it. And it bowls right by it as though it was nothing.
Yeah.
And it's not nothing.
No, that's a good point.
For me, the point where the movie kind of falls apart, especially in terms of the characters, is Wade gets into a sort of an obsessive situation with another character that he knows only as an avatar called Artemis,
mm-hmm.
played by Olivia Cooke. And he tells her roughly 3 seconds into their relationship, "I love you." And it's a disturbing moment,
yeah,
as it should be. And she says, "You don't know me. You have no idea who I am. You have no idea what I look like. You don't know anything about my real life, my backstory." That is an incredibly mature and meaningful point in the middle of this movie
right.
about avatars and video games and online presentation, and the movie completely ignores it.
Mm-hmm.
He bowls right past it. They meet each other in real life, and he goes straight into, no, seriously, I love you.
Mm-hmm.
And she takes it like it's meaningful. And it's so frustrating to see a movie make such an intelligent point and then just completely drop it in favor of a quote-unquote love story.
Yeah.
That, I mean, Romeo and Juliet's, we met at a party, we were 13, and now we're in love, and we should commit suicide for each other. Like, it makes that look thought through by comparison.
Yeah, I think Ty Sheridan does a fine job playing Wade / Parzival here. I like him as an actor. I always have in the films, especially seeing him in Mud, the Jeff Nichols film. But I do think he's a thinly drawn character here, and he's not entirely consistent. And I get the sense that as a character, he does probably evolve and grow as a person from the beginning through the end of this quest. But man, it happens fast. The movie seems to want to suggest he's the kind of guy who has no sense of really the larger world at all, who will say to that girl and not understand at all when she responds saying, well, no, you don't really know me. He hasn't really thought about any of those things. He's like a young boy who just says, no, I love you because you're the first girl who's ever paid any attention to me. He's a dork, and that's fine. You can derive a lot of humor from that, and the movie does in certain moments. And then the last half of this film, he's kind of a conventional action hero. He all of a sudden turns into the guy who more or less knows the cool thing to say in certain moments and seems to be completely in control and understands what he's facing. It just seemed inconsistent to me with the character the movie had initially set him up to be.
That said, once again, he's a pretty considerable improvement on the version of the character in the book, who is the kind of person who literally stages victories over other people by knowing more trivia than they do and sneering people down for not success. Like, how dare you say you know a lot about that
video
game?
That sounds terrible.
Can you name the three sequels to it? Yeah, I mean, it's a book written as wish fulfillment for dorks like me who know a lot of culture and don't necessarily know how to interface with other people around it in ways that aren't a little spastic and overly excited. With that in mind, one of the things I liked most about this film is the banter. It's it's a very funny movie. It's very fast-paced. People zing back and forth with each other verbally. And that also can be a very strong part of nerd culture.
Mm.
When you all know all of the same references, when you're comfortable with somebody enough to tease them, even if you feel awkward with outsiders or strangers, there is a lot of camaraderie that goes on in this movie that feels very naturalistic and hilarious. And for me, one of the strongest parts of it was the open acknowledgement of a very specific kind of gamer humor. And that mostly comes from a character named IROC, who is a more developed henchman to the main bad guy.
He's kind of a bounty hunter. He gets things.
Yeah, he's kind of a super successful bounty hunter character who does what he's told. But he's built as this sort of monster avatar of extreme badassitude, and the person behind the avatar keeps breaking that character, and it never fails to be funny to me. It's a repeated acknowledgement of exactly that thing, that how you present yourself online and who you really are very different things. And the film goes back to that well of humor over and over, and to me it was always successful. It was always funny. Maybe because it was so dry and it didn't take itself seriously the way, for instance, the love story tries to.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. And I'm glad you specifically highlighted those moments of comedy, because you did touch on in your review feeling like the movie is funny and that it showcases the humor properly. And I was trying to think back on the movie and think back on the moments that actually did make me laugh, because I knew there were some, but I'll be honest, I was really not able to recall any, at least any of significance between those main characters, between Parzival and Artemis. But that character, who is voiced by T.J. Miller in this movie, is the one that consistently made me laugh. And I think it is because exactly what you're getting at. He's always undercutting that machismo that comes through in these avatar versions of these characters, where you even see it in Ben Mendelsohn as the villain. I love it. He's supposed to be this super powerful guy, and yet when he goes into the Oasis, he's like a video game mobster who seems like he's 9 feet tall and he's got the huge chest and the gigantic suit on. He even has to envision himself as being somehow much bigger and stronger and invincible than he obviously is.
And yet, one of the things I found a little fascinating about this film is he's presented as a character with not a whole lot of imagination. Mm-hmm. His entire goal is to take control of the Oasis and monetize it, slap ads all over it. His version of himself, his avatar in this world where you can be literally anything you want to be, is just a bigger businessman.
That's it.
With a bigger chest.
A bigger businessman.
He still has a tie. He's a super business dude with a tie. So it's just, it's very clear that he does not have the colorful imagination that other people have.
No.
Now, one of the things that's interesting about this world is just the visual interpretation of it. Artemis and Wade's avatar Parzival and H, his buddy who's played by Lena Waithe, they're all these very uncanny valley-looking versions of humanity. Parzival is kind of elfin. He's too narrow. He has a painted face. He has blue-tipped hair that's constantly floating in a dramatic, flattering breeze. You know, Artemis, similarly, is very elfin and inhuman-looking. People have the ability to envision themselves however they like in this world. And I think that the movie makes very interesting and exciting and dynamic visual use of this without ever stopping to explain. Nobody has to sit down and say, I look this way because I think it's cool. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to be a partially mechanical man because blah, blah, blah. It's just
understood.
Understood.
Yeah.
You know,
wouldn't
that
we want to do that too?
Cool. Yes, exactly. And that's the wish fulfillment aspect of this movie, I think, is executed really, really well in terms of how everybody gets to express themselves however they want, and it's fun.
Yeah, no, I certainly agree with that point. And one more note that you have in your review, actually, you lead with this, comparing it to the book a little bit. You say that one of the ways it's an improvement, and it certainly sounds like it would be, even though I confess again, I haven't read the book. In that source material, if you're going to drop all of those references, you literally have to drop them. You can't really sneak in references, right, in a written piece. You can't have Easter eggs, to use the parlance of this movie, of course, as well. But in a movie, you can. You can fill a frame with all these things that one person sitting in the audience doesn't see any of them. One person might see five of them. One person might see 50 of them. As visual elements, they work in this world, whereas in the written version of it, you really do have to digest every single one of those references, and that can be cumbersome. At least you argue that it is in the Klein book.
It certainly is in the early going of the Klein book, where he literally devotes entire pages to just listing stuff that he read and watched and listened to and digested in order to better understand Halliday's point of view. In the movie, you get to go into these worlds. Instead of having somebody list them to you, you get to just be immersed in them. When he goes into the library and he watches Holiday's life, he's getting to sort of live along with these things. Now, I think it's interesting that you found that like warming, engaging. I find it terrifying.
Yeah, no, but that's what I mean by provocative. Also scary in a way. I was really drawn to the notion of it, though, like the ramifications of that.
Oh, the ramifications of it is that there's a camera in this studio and everything that we're saying right now would be recorded.
But see, that's not how I read it, though. I read it as the fact that it is real, but also, as I understood it, and maybe I misunderstood it, a recreation of life, because it's basically taking their likenesses and taking it from a written word and then, like a filmmaker, it's making a movie out of it. That's not really them in those actual moments. That's a program bringing a virtual reality version of how that played out. That's how I interpret it.
That's interesting. And I thought it was all taken from basically studio cameras, observational cameras.
No, it's as I heard it, it's programmed diaries, basically. Mm-hmm. And so it's using these versions of themselves. And so it's real because it's based on the real thing. And yet there is some artifice to it. There's some remove. Maybe it didn't play out exactly that way. Maybe a certain word wasn't said or a phrase wasn't said that way, or he wasn't doing that action when he said it. But the gist of it is accurate. So think about all those key moments in your life that you've written down maybe, and then someone dramatizes that in a way later, and how that would be perceived by people, and having your kids or future generations watch it. It blew me away. I wanted the movie just to go down that rabbit hole and none of the other gamer stuff that it went into.
Well, that is much less creepy. You compared it to Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. I went to a more Truman Show kind of place where everybody is always observed and everything will be preserved and analyzed later. And it seemed, you know, fascinating and necessary both for the story and for Holiday's game, but still just kind of creepy.
Yeah, no, without a doubt. I think either way you view it, it's potentially creepy. But I think that's what did fascinate me a little bit. And just before we sat down, you brought up the David Ehrlich article over at IndieWire, which I've just seen the headline of, so I don't know how much we want to get into it. We'll link to it. But if you want to bring up that headline, that provocative headline from David, do you have it in front of you, Tasha?
Yeah, the headline was, Steven Spielberg invented the modern blockbuster, but Ready Player One suggests he might regret it. It went up on IndieWire on April 3rd. And David's point here is that Spielberg's making a series of movies that feel elegiac, that he's considering his own legacy and he's making movies over and over about the legacies that people leave behind.
Okay.
You know, movies like The Post, for instance. Now, I would argue that Spielberg making The Post is less about considering the legacies that people leave behind and more about his lifelong obsession with heroes, with people who stand up for what's right, with
integrity.
Yeah, with people in desperate situations who won't budge in the face of...
We'll do a certain code.
Yeah,
sure.
Dramatic and horrible change. But that's as maybe. David makes the point that Spielberg is kind of looking back on his own past and seeing decades upon decades of blockbusters stemming from Jaws, basically, and him creating the idea of the modern blockbuster, and that we've come to a point where blockbusters have been corporatized, where they're regurgitating the same pieces, the same artifacts of culture over and over, and where they're essentially no longer creating new things for themselves. Mm-hmm. So if you look at Ready Player One as a metaphor for Spielberg's career, well, I don't know. Do you want to do that or not?
I don't know.
I think it's a really interesting point to make given how many people seem to be taking this film as a very yay or nay, up or down, nostalgia good, nostalgia bad, this movie is shallow and dumb versus this movie references all the things I love, so it's great. Like, this is a deeper reading of it. I'm not entirely convinced that it's there.
Okay.
But I like the fact that somebody is sort of taking the time to pick apart like a larger symbolism where Holiday means a little more than a chance to regurgitate Ernest Cline's favorite everything.
Yeah, no, I like that notion as well. It's funny too because despite, of course, pointing out that I am a child of the 80s, now I will have that image in my head forever. Tasha.
It's a drippy egg sack.
I was neither excited nor turned off by the cornucopia of references. There was something about seeing that DeLorean, of course, the Back to the Future car that maybe initially you go, hey, it's the Back to the Future car. But that didn't excite me any more than seeing the Iron Giant pop up at some point really excited me. It was fine, but it didn't give me that thrill that maybe it gives some viewers. But I also wasn't one of those viewers who felt like, okay, this is just a bunch of nonsense where they're preying on our love for nostalgia and that's all it wants us to respond to. It didn't really work for me or not work for me on that level. But I brought up that article only because it seems to tie back to something I did jot down here, which is you could argue that this movie is a weird kind of defense of the auteur theory, right? Which basically the movie says that everything you'd ever want to know about Halliday's work, you can know by understanding his life, by understanding
his creations,
and by understanding his personality, even the things that happened to him as a person, what defines him as a man in this case also can help you understand what defines him as an artist. And that's why they're all looking for those clues. And I mean, that seems to me, maybe I'm reading it too simply, but the most basic version of the notion that, well, you know a film is made by a certain filmmaker when you understand all of the impulses that they have as a man or a woman as they are divulged or revealed throughout their work. And we can basically create kind of a profile of them through their work. Of course, in most of those cases, we really know nothing about these people as people other than maybe what Us Weekly or People Magazine might show us. Otherwise, it's only from the work that we can derive a sense of their personality. Here, we can go back, as we said, and actually watch these moments play out. But I just thought that was fascinating, that it seems to be almost a defense of the idea that the director is someone who is imprinting who he is as a person on everything he does as a filmmaker or as a creator.
Wow, there's a lot to unpack there. And I guess the first thing that leaps to mind is just how fascinating it is to the idea of having an auteur behind a video game. of this, particularly of this size. The Oasis is a vast and complicated universe that contains all of these separate worlds. And when you look at the number of people involved in creating a single, like, AAA video game, the idea of, like, a single person putting their stamp all over it in a defining way is a little hilarious to me. And sometimes a little hilarious when you look at a film and have that
Absolutely.
Same sort of thing. But in both cases, I think it's just – it's a very tempting thing to simplify.
Yeah.
It's very tempting to be able to say this thing was created by one person and that one person's personality defined every aspect of it, because then suddenly you have something easy to grasp, like comfortable to hold on to. And in the case of Ready Player One, it's the same sort of thing. If you understand this one moment in this man's life where he saw this one thing and it was very important to him, then you understand
you can
how to solve the puzzle.
Yes.
And you literally walk into his mind and communicate with him. That's such a tempting fantasy.
It is. It is. And I think a lot of us as viewers do succumb to that sometimes. And maybe that's what Spielberg is, in fact, playing with. I can't really get into this, or you can't really respond properly to this because it divulges too much information about the movie. But you could argue that a key part of the climax of this film reinforces the idea of a single solitary creator actually driving all of this. So I don't know. There's something there that's at least, I suppose, fun to talk about in shows like this one.
The other thing that you bring up that just kind of resonates with me, I mean, you say that there was no one particular reference that thrilled you, that really, you know, got into your head.
Did you have one?
I had a couple. One was the Iron Giant.
Okay.
And in a way—
And I love the Iron Giant.
Now, there are people who are very upset about the use of the Iron Giant here because he gets into a battle and he's zapping things. And that's the exact opposite of the original film. To which I say, it's not the Iron Giant. It's somebody's avatar of a cool vehicle that is shaped like the Iron Giant. It's somebody who thinks the Iron Giant would be cool to stomp around in. The fact that it's being treated that he is now a gun in addition to being Superman is just indicative of how we take these nostalgic artifacts, these pop culture things, and we repurpose them according to our own fantasies. I think that that's as meaningful a moment as anything else in the film, because it says when we seize onto something like that, part of geek culture is also grabbing things and making them your own, because whatever resonates with them for you is not necessarily what resonates with them for somebody else.
Yeah, no.
Seeing the Iron Giant in the film was a thrill for me because it was a reminder that there are other people out there that think that movie is as cool as I think it is.
Sure.
And given how poorly it did at the box office and how it was kind of like a hidden gem that had to be slowly found and turned into a cult item over the years, seeing it slapped up there on the screen as a signifier of awesome is just really fun to me. I had a similar reaction to this one I'm not going to give away, but as we kind of danced around it earlier, the whole second key quest.
Yes, and I did appreciate that one as well. Yes, I will give you that one.
There's just a lot going on there that is indicative of a certain kind of appreciation and attention to detail that I just found really fun.
Absolutely, and I think that's that moment where you feel like you're ahead of the game a little bit as a viewer because you're ahead of the characters, because you know that world. You know, even maybe before they do, what's going to happen, what's going to be around that corner, literally, in some cases. And that's really satisfying. So you've talked about this a little bit, too, this idea of pop culture. I was confused a little bit, and before we sat down to tape, I brought it up, this idea of nostalgia here and this 80s culture being the only thing everyone in this version of 2045 cares about, and how I didn't completely understand that. And of course, it is tied to the fact that they're all so obsessed with Halliday and winning this contest that they become obsessed with this old culture because it's what he was obsessed with. And they are looking for those clues. So I get that. But I think maybe there was a part of me still that felt like I wanted to understand, why do they, if not all of them, why do some of them, like Wade, not just appreciate it because they're supposed to, or they're told they need to, but why do they actually love it? What is it about that car, the Iron Giant, some of those other references, some of those other things they've seen in these movies and become so familiar with? What is it that really does connect with them, short of them being able to turn it into a cool vehicle or make it part of their avatar, part of who they are in this virtual world? I didn't really get that. And I think one of the things I was curious about is whether or not one of the ideas at the core of this film is that you can't really create new culture if you are stuck in this virtual world, because as we've noted, everyone seems so obsessed with the Oasis that they're not connected to their everyday reality, and no new culture seems to be being created. It's just this appreciation for the old culture. And so is Spielberg suggesting somehow that pop culture really is only created? We can only have new culture if it comes through art and it comes through engaging in the real world that's around you as opposed to this type of environment. If it is, the movie doesn't seem to really explore that a little bit. But what do you make of the idea anyway that they only are obsessed with this culture from the past? And the movie doesn't suggest that there's any real notion of culture that exists right now in this version of 2045.
I think that in the book, it's very clear that the reason they think 80s culture is the best culture, the most awesomest, coolest thing ever invented, is because the author Ernest Cline thinks that. I think that they're all caught up like very visibly and obviously within his mindset. They all kind of speak with the same voice. They're all kind of the same character with different faces. I think the movie pushes farther into the idea that people can be pack rats about stuff from any era. I think that the sort of field from which they're drawing is at least a little wider.
Is it? Okay.
However, they're also limited by what they could get the rights to. I mean, sadly, yeah. You know, this isn't a Who Framed Roger Rabbit situation where they were able to pull in things from all sorts of different studios and get all of the different things that Ernest Cline loved that people remember from the 80s. They had to stick with things that Warner Brothers somehow has their fingers in or could borrow.
So I was thinking about that as I was watching it and was wondering if they were able to somehow transcend those limitations, because I noticed so many references, I thought, well, they can't possibly have the rights to all those, can they?
Well,
but you're saying they
did.
An
awful lot of those things come down to some Warner Brothers conglomerate thing. And in some cases where in the book it was something else, they changed it to something that they had access to. Mm. So they're operating with a few more limitations there. In the movie, I think it's a little more complicated in terms of why they love these things. I think that you could make a very interesting argument that Wade in particular loves these things because they were the culture that he steeped himself in when he was 13 years old, which is about the age where an awful lot of us kind of break off and start discovering things for ourselves.
For sure.
Outside of the arena of the things we grew up with. And that's where a lot of things imprint on us. That's where a lot of the things that we grow up and that we hold on to with that tight-fisted grip that says, you will take this away from me over my dead body. That's where a lot of that comes in. Holiday's been dead for 5 years. The quest has been happening for 5 years. Wade is 18 years old. This is now the culture of his youth,
yeah,
as well as the culture of Holiday's youth. Mm. I don't think that the film makes enough of that point. I don't think it makes enough of the point that no new culture is being created. I don't think it makes enough of various other things that it gives kind of lip service to.
Right.
One of the big things for me was there's a moment towards the end where Wade calls up in real life a lot of people to help support him. And the movie gets a big emotional beat, a big emotional moment out of the idea of this collective action and organization and people standing up together to protest and fight the man. And it instantly comes to nothing.
Yes.
I found that very frustrating.
Me too.
Because the movie tries to get the emotional aspect out of it without going any further into the message or the idea.
No.
And I think that that happens several times during this film. One of the things that the film brings up is the idea that spending too much time in a virtual world may be harmful and may keep you from engaging with the real world. And you get like a couple of lines about that towards the end. It's supposed to be a big moral. It is not in any way felt by the rest of the movie.
No.
Where everything awesome pretty much happens in the Oasis.
Everything. Yeah.
So there's a lot that this movie either implies but doesn't get into, or outright says but doesn't feel or doesn't explore. That is why I wonder about that four-hour version.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are a lot of things that could have been done more thoughtfully and in more detail and better here. And it's just that you get that kind of frustration because the things the movie does well are just like rip-roaring awesome, and the things that it does poorly undermine the awesome parts.
You can see for yourself if you haven't already and let us know what you think. Ready Player One is currently out in wide release. We'd love to hear your thoughts. Feedback@filmspotting.net is the email.
When we come back, all the movies that have tried to pull off a Goodfellas-inspired tracking shot and more movie homages. The Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us.
Okay, what's your location? I'm right here. cohabitating in a human form on planet Earth where I was born. And I like it here, I do, though people tell me that this place is through. But F that, man, I just got here. No one exists who's not here. This is the only place anyone is. And I will admit, maybe I'm only here a bit. Some parts of me don't fit here. They go bulging out into the ether. It's like the front of my face is all that really gets to be here. But I want to come through, persist. I'm going to form all my cells into the shape of a fist. I'll be going at the air until there's room to exist. I'm going to get up, get up, get up, get up, get up, get up.
A peasant in the field, I want to feel the sun pouring into him like it does in the corn.
Is that what you think you're doing when you overload your brush? When you slap paint on like putty? When you make your trees writhe like snakes and your sun explode all over the canvas? With all your talk and motion, what I see when I look at your work is just that you paint too fast.
You look too fast!
Those two, you know, they really should have had a podcast, I think. Kirk Douglas as Vincent van Gogh, Anthony Quinn as Paul Gauguin in 1956's Lust for Life. It's the fifth movie in our ongoing Vincent Minnelli marathon. Reviews of these movies appear as bonus episodes in the Film Spotting feed. So if you are already subscribed to the podcast, you'll find those episodes appearing on Wednesdays. And that's where you can find our conversation about Lust for Life, along with earlier reviews of Cabin in the Sky, Meet Me in St. Louis, The Bad and the Beautiful, and The Bandwagon. Tasha, I don't want to put you on the spot, but any strong feelings about Vincent Minnelli or any of these films?
I have a strong feeling that I should watch more Vincent Minnelli.
That's where we were at, yes.
I was just watching, because we were prepping our top five, which is top five movies that pay homage to other movies. I've been reading and watching a lot of things online about movies that quote other movies. And I came back to La La Land, and there was a terrific video out there that puts scenes from La La Land side by side with the movies that they're quoting. It's so much deeper and more complicated than I would have imagined. And it brings me back to a place of there are so many classic musicals that I haven't seen. And Vincent Minnelli directed so many of them. Looking down his list of films, I've seen maybe eight of these, and there are 40 of them, so I've got a long way to go.
Still, that's not bad. I think I was only at two or three before this marathon began. You can find the full lineup for Minnelli and our past marathons at filmspotting.net/marathons. You can subscribe to the podcast in Apple Podcasts or your preferred podcast app. You can also listen at our website, filmspotting.net. The Minnelli Marathon is presented by Mubi. An algorithm has no business choosing your films. Mubi is a curated online cinema streaming exceptional films from around the globe. Every day they introduce a new gem and you have 1 month to watch it. Whether it's a timeless classic, a festival darling, or an acclaimed masterpiece, each film is hand-selected by experts. This week's highlights include Mubi's exclusive streaming premiere of Philippe Gurel's Lover for a Day, which they're showing along with Gurel's entire trilogy of love. That's another blind spot for me, the work of Philippe Gurel. Lover for a Day hits Mubi fresh from its theatrical run, and they're pairing it with Gurel's prior two films, Jealousy and In the Shadow of Women. Each film is shot in what Mubi describes as luscious black and white celluloid and told with the brisk concision of the finest 19th century novellas. This collection perfectly embodies Gurel's gift for capturing the anguish, beauty, and complexity of love. Film Spotting listeners can try Mubi free for 30 days at mubi.com/filmspotting. That's mubi.com/filmspotting. Next week, Michael Phillips will be sitting in for Josh, and we're going to talk about the new horror film, A Quiet Place, with Emily Blunt. It's directed by Mr. Emily Blunt, John Krasinski. Michael will also join me for the final movie in our Minnelli Marathon, Some Came Running, starring Shirley MacLaine, Frank Sinatra, and Dean Martin. And we might just do a top five list as well. If you have any good ideas for that show, we'd always love to hear them. Feedback at filmspotting.net. Now, the question that you asked me earlier, Tasha, where is Josh?
Where is Josh?
Where is Josh? From the 9th through the 13th of this month, he is in Boulder, Colorado, back at the Conference on World Affairs, hosting Ebert Interruptus. And he did this last year, screening over multiple days, I believe, his beloved Rushmore by Wes Anderson. One of those cases where the name says it, Interruptus. The people are there. They can stop the movie at any time and shout out whatever comment they have about the film. They basically go through it frame by frame. This year, they're giving that treatment to George Miller's Mad Max Fury Road. They're also having a Film Spotting meetup out there. It's on Thursday, April 12th at The Sink in Boulder, time to be announced, but just check filmspotting.net/events for more details on that. Also at filmspotting.net/events is where we have movie passes to give away, and we're giving away some for the new film from Andrew Hay, the director of 45 Years and Weekend, both great films. His new one, Lean on Pete, is coming out soon here in Chicago, and if you'd like to see that movie for free in advance of its release, you can find those passes over at our website. One other quick bit of housekeeping here. We got a note from Kelly Warren, who's the executive director of WMUU in Madison, Wisconsin. Film Spotting is actually on WMUU every Friday, and there are some weekend evenings there as well. Kelly wanted to let us and you know that the 19th annual Wisconsin Film Festival is currently running through the 12th of this month. It's affiliated with the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and it's the largest university-produced film fest in the U.S. They're screening 150 films at various venues around town. More information about the fest is available at wifilmfest.org. Madison is a great town, a great movie town. Our thanks to Kelly, and thanks to WMUU.
Yeah.
Who's this?
This is Vinny.
Vinny, what happened? Well, everything straightened out?
No, we had a problem. I mean, we tried to do everything we could.
What do you mean?
Well, you know what I mean. He's gone. And we couldn't do nothing about it. That's it.
What do you mean? What do you mean?
He's gone. He's gone.
I'm not sure what's the equivalent these days to destroying a telephone booth. Hopefully it doesn't come to that when we announce who got offed this week in the Film Spotting Madness final four matchups. We started, Tasha, with 64 of the best movies of the 90s. We've worked our way down now to two. We'll get to those results in a second. As we noted last week, all four of our top four seeds made it to the final four. So no major upsets along the way. Pulp Fiction, Goodfellas, Fargo, and The Silence of the Lambs all made it to the semifinal. And let's go ahead and share those results now. Number one seed Pulp Fiction versus number four seed Silence of the Lambs. We heard from Mike H. in Pensacola, Florida.
It's funny. I came into this tournament remembering Silence of the Lambs with fondness. Not an all-time great film, but a better-than-average mood piece with Hopkins' uniquely powerful performance at the center of it, which I understood to be the only real reason it deserved its otherwise inexplicable lasting presence in our cultural psyche. Now seeing it beat out much better films round after round has changed my whole perspective. I now see that the film is actually severely overrated on a scale I never realized. Seriously, it's a cool procedural, but what in the double-decker blue holy hell are you people drinking? This movie is a contender for greatest of the entire decade to somebody? To a lot of somebodies? The real villain here is all of you, I scream as I stand over the mangled body of Dazed and Confused. The real villain has been you the whole time.
The whole time.
What a great letter.
What a great letter, though. Mike, have you seen The Silence of the Lambs in a while? Because it's so much better than you're giving it credit for. Julio Oliveira in Austin says simply, Royale with cheese, greater than fava beans.
Yeah, you're cutting him short by about 12 greater than signs.
I am.
There.
You're right. Doesn't really translate to radio, does it? Now, we have the results. How would you have voted in this one, Tasha? Is this a slam dunk for Tarantino, or do you give The Silence of the Lambs much more credit than just being a cool procedural?
This is a rough, rough vote, and I don't want somebody swearing double-decker blue holy hell at me, but I would have gone with Silence of the Lambs in this one.
Oh, no. Mike H., the emails are going to come in.
but thanks to your numerical process, I know exactly what percentage of your voters I'm offending here.
Exactly right. In this case, it's 66% of the voters went with Pulp Fiction, only 34% for Silence of the Lambs. So the number one seed moves on. There you go, Mike. Are you happy? Pulp Fiction finally took down Hannibal Lecter. The number two seed, Goodfellas, versus the number three seed, Fargo, from the Coen brothers. Reed Ramsey in Knoxville, Tennessee, writes, here's the deal, guys. You barged uninvited into my house wearing ski masks while I was knitting and watching the local news. You shattered my screen door, and then you marched upstairs and proceeded to destroy some of my all-time favorite movies. Hoop Dreams, Kieslowski's Blue and Red, Clueless, Out of Sight, The Iron Giant, Groundhog Day, and The Insider. Then, as you were callously throwing those great movies to their death down the stairs, you picked up my favorite movie of all time, Fargo, and the movie that introduced me to loving movies, Goodfellas. Now, the choice for me is clear, but the cruelty of making me rat on Goodfellas is unbearable.
Are the metaphors always this colorful
yes.
in Film Spotting
lists? Oh, yes.
My goodness. Well, Kevin Kiley writes, did anyone ever say, all my life I wanted to be a Midwest cop? I didn't think so.
If anyone ever said that, maybe the Coen brothers would have written that as opening voiceover. But no, they didn't. Compelling argument, Kevin.
Kevin, nobody knew that they wanted to be a pregnant Midwest cop.
Until Marge Gunderson?
Until Marge Gunderson.
Okay.
And then they knew.
Tough to argue with that. Tom from Westfield, New Jersey closes us out. He says, these are both all-time favorites for me, so I'm fine with either moving on. But I listen to Film Spotting to be entertained, and I can think of no more entertaining result in this round than listening to Josh celebrate the sheer schadenfreude of Adam not winning the tournament. Despite Josh's own inevitable last place finish, so Fargo gets my vote. Well, whatever entices you to vote however you do, Tom, I'm glad to be here for you. Though I said it last week, and I truly mean it, winning this contest doesn't actually matter that much to me because there's no prize. There's only the punishment for losing. So all I really care about is that I didn't finish last. And wait, I'm not going to finish last.
Is the punishment for losing getting dragged into a basement with a bunch of men in gimp suits with baseball bats?
It is not. It's maybe worse, actually. You have to watch the latest film on Netflix from Adam Sandler.
Oh, no. No, 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 no. All right, I'm going to vote early and vote often.
Yeah, no kidding. Here are the results. And Tasha, go ahead and do the honors. We have our first big upset of the tournament.
This is a huge upset.
Even though it's just a 3 seed taking down 2, but still, it was unlikely.
It's interestingly close. But and 45% of your listeners got it wrong and voted for Goodfellas. But Fargo has it with a fat, comfortable 55%.
55%. Fargo does move on. Your championship matchup is Tarantino's Pulp Fiction versus the Coen brothers. Fargo. You went against Pulp Fiction when it was competing against The Silence of the Lambs. You obviously wanted Fargo to win. What do you do here?
My choice is utterly
Fargo is clear, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I love both films dearly, so it's a tough one for me. I'm probably still giving the edge just slightly to Pulp Fiction. Philip Schmidt writes in, I nominate Steve Buscemi as 2018's Madness MVP. By my count, he's a critical supporting player in 7 Madness films. And to think by the end of all this, we'll only have record of his turn as Buddy Holly the waiter. Madness! Exclamation point, Philip says. And I really hadn't done the math, but it's true. He's undoubtedly the MVP. He's in Fargo, The Big Lebowski, Miller's Crossing, and Barton Fink. All 4 were part of Film Spotting Madness. He's in Tarantino's Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs. And he's got an uncredited role in Jim Jarmusch's Dead Man.
I mean, Steve Buscemi is the MVP of everything.
Of everything.
Pretty much.
Yeah, I agree.
Him and Michael Shannon and a very few others just belong up there in the stratosphere.
Okay, well, we disagree on all of these choices, but we agree on that, Tasha. A runner-up MVP, we think, unless someone else finds some others that we're overlooking, Samuel L. Jackson shows up in 5 Madness films, Pulp Fiction, Jackie Brown, Goodfellas, Jurassic Park, along with a great cameo in Soderbergh's Out of Sight. So close. Close to Steve Buscemi. I mean, that's a battle. That's its own kind of death match if you only had to choose between Samuel L. Jackson and Steve Buscemi.
As long as it's not a literal death match.
Exactly.
Because I know who would win that contest.
We all know who's going to win that one. So where do we stand on our own death match, the bracket contest? We'll find out who is going to win and who is going to have to suffer through yet another Adam Sandler movie as we embark on the championship matchup. Mike Merrigan, the founding father of Film Spotting Madness. He's got 131 points. He is the only one who correctly picked Pulp Fiction to face Fargo. He had it right in the final. I am in second place with 128 points. I had Fiction versus Goodfellas. Sam also had Pulp Fiction versus Goodfellas. He's in third just behind me with 125 points. And there's Josh in last place. He had Pulp Fiction versus Before Sunrise, which I think lost in the second round. Now, we thought that all 4 of us had Pulp Fiction winning the whole thing. So if that's the case, no matter how this final finished, Mike would be our bracket champ. But then we had this email exchange. Mike reminded me of this. I think it was Mike at the time who was the only one who had submitted his bracket yet. And Josh wrote in, I dare one of you to not make Pulp Fiction the champion. And Mike said, you know what? I ain't afraid of no ghosts. Go ahead and switch my winner from Pulp Fiction to Fargo. I'll go with my heart over my head. Fortune favors the bold. So there you go. Even though his printout bracket had Pulp Fiction winning over Fargo, it is true. He asked for it to be changed before the tournament started. So now, if Fargo does beat Pulp Fiction, Mike will win it all. But if Pulp Fiction wins, Mike's actually going to finish 3rd. And more importantly, as I said, no matter which movie wins for the 3rd year in a row, Josh is our big loser.
I can hear Adam Sandler calling right now.
Anna Husted in Montana wrote in, hey guys, I just wanted to share that going into the final 4, I had 47 points. Hopefully this makes Josh feel better about his fourth place finish. Where is the Linklater love? Yeah, I'm bummed about how Linklater was treated in this tournament as well. But there you go. Josh is going to finish last. I could win it. Pulp Fiction, though, has to beat Fargo. Otherwise, Mike Merrigan will win. The voting is open now. Polls close on Monday, April 9th at 5 p.m. And the winner will be announced next week. To participate in all the madness fun, just go to filmspotting.net/madness. Tu amor se llevó todo mi corazón y quedó llorando, llorando, llorando. That's singer Rebecca Del Rio in David Lynch's Mulholland Drive, a moving and surreal moment in Lynch's movie that is somehow even eerier in the way that it evokes a similar scene in Singin' in the Rain. In that film, Gene Hagen's Lena Lamont is lip-syncing the title song when a curtain is yanked up behind her, revealing Debbie Reynolds. Kathy is the actual singer. Of course, in Mulholland, the singer suddenly passes out on the stage. The song, though, continues uninterrupted. This scene, this movie, not eligible for this top five, are movie homages, or homages in movies to other movies, to be more specific, because Mulholland Drive is in the Film Spotting pantheon. I do have one note I have to share about this connection here. Three or four summers ago, I taught one of my classes at the Graham School at the University of Chicago, and it was on movies about movies. And of course, I did my due diligence. I put a lot of work into the syllabus and the order of the screenings, and there was some science and structure to it, but you can't always anticipate how things are going to line up. And sometimes there are wondrous surprises, like following up Singin' in the Rain week two with Mulholland Drive week three. And that aha moment that I had and everyone else in the class had watching that exact scene where Rebecca Del Rio passes out, but the song continues. And the reference, it seemed to be, it was all clear in our minds anyway, to Singin' in the Rain. I felt like, for just that fleeting moment, the greatest film instructor of all time. It was fleeting, but it mattered in the moment, Tasha.
I remember a film class where we were talking about television and how it related to film. And I got to bring in the very early days of The Simpsons, before it was obvious that every episode references all of the films ever created, I got to bring in the sequence that visually references the murder scene in Psycho. And I got to subject an unknowing class of 18-year-olds to the stabbing scene in Psycho completely out of context, which is a little rough.
Yeah.
And then show them the Simpsons scene.
Amazing.
That walks through it, like image by image by image.
Okay.
Putting these things together in somebody's eyes is just always fun.
Yeah. I think you probably have a good sense of what the topic is here, what the types of movies and moments we're going to be picking are. But I will say that earlier today, I thought maybe we should call this Top 5 Movie Easter Eggs, because that's a direct tie-in, obviously, to the pursuit of Ready Player One, the movie that inspired this top five. But Easter eggs are different, at least in how I perceive them, right? They are these things that can kind of be hidden in the frame to an extent. And here with movie homages, these are more blatant, more direct references and allusions to something that came before. Is that how you also approached it?
Absolutely. I think of an Easter egg as a very colorful thing hidden somewhere, a very small thing that if you look closely, you might pick up. Everything on my list is much more blatant,
yeah,
protracted.
Nothing and, hidden here,
yeah,
really.
It's about evoking a moment and a feeling from one film within another film.
Exactly. Okay. Well, I can't wait to hear your list. We're going to get it started with your number five.
Well, number five could itself be 100 items long. I'm a great fan of Pixar movies. The people who create Pixar movies are great fans of reference. All Pixar movies more or less reference the Pixar movies that came before them. The Easter eggs are many and varied. So I had a really hard time narrowing this down to one, and I didn't quite. I'm going to call this a tie because
I love it when I'm not the one cheating. I fully endorse this.
I think it's necessary to cheat as hard as possible if you're going to win. And I'm going to win this one. So there are two big Pixar movie references within movies that really stand out for me. One of them comes in The Incredibles when Mr. Incredible and Frozone have ended up in a jewelry shop after escaping a blazing fire. And a cop pulls a gun on them and tries to get them to stand down. And Frozone says, I need to get a drink of water, and slowly gets a drink of water from the cooler next to him so he can get enough water in order to freeze the cop. That sequence, I always felt played a little weirdly on screen. And then I found out that it is a beat-by-beat recreation of a scene from Die Hard with a Vengeance.
Wow.
Where a cop who looks a very nervous transit cop who looks visually identical to the one in The Incredibles pulls a gun on Samuel L. Jackson,
yeah,
who voices Frozone, because he has jumped over the turnstile in a mass transit system in an effort to get to a phone where he needs to listen to the instructions of a terrorist bomber who's controlling the city. The same thing happens. Nervous cop pulls a gun on him, tries to get him to stand down. The phone rings. Samuel L. Jackson says very reasonably, I have to answer this phone, and then continues to push and push until he's finally able to answer the phone.
I have to answer that phone.
Get him up! Freeze!
I'm thirsty.
I said freeze!
I'm just getting a drink.
Beat for beat, tone for tone, moment for moment, shot for shot,
wow,
and absolutely within the design of the cop himself. You can find a mashup of the two of them on YouTube pretty readily, and it's really fun to explore.
Hmm.
A tie with that will be much easier to describe. This just, it's such a little thing, but I love it so very, very much. In the original Toy Story, the evil child Sid, who lives next door to the family that where most of the action takes place, he is a sadist and a monster, and the toys are all afraid of him because of the things he does. Eventually, the action moves to within Sid's home, and we see that the carpeting on the floor of that house is the carpeting from The Shining. It's an uncommented on visual gag.
Yeah.
And I love it so much.
Huh.
It's subtle. As subtle as that hideous pattern can possibly be. And it just evokes for people in the know so much of the eerie, unsettling mm-hmm. tone of The Shining.
Yeah.
And the horror that the characters
yeah.
feel. So there
those
is.
Are great. Those
my,
are great.
My top 5.5 and 5.
Uh-huh.
I'm just going to call it all one big thing saying Pixar does a lot of visual references, and I love them for it.
Well, I did my own version of cheating here, I guess, which was to force myself to exclude certain options so I would avoid cheating. I had three rules I came up with. One of them was I was not going to reference any type of remake, which I think is probably fair, though I wouldn't begrudge you if you did it. But for example, I'm not going to pick a moment from A Fistful of Dollars, which is clearly an homage. The whole thing is a riff on Kurosawa's Yojimbo. So that just didn't seem right to me. One of my other rules was I was going to discount all of Pixar because there's just too many to pick from. And it just didn't seem right. So I have one more. My question to you, though, Tasha, is Die Hard with a Vengeance a movie we really needed that allusion to?
You know, I don't think that it is. And that actually makes it all the more delightful to
yeah.
me. The idea that somebody seized on that scene so closely that they needed to recreate it in an
right.
unrelated film.
It's pretty amazing.
I think it's
pretty
fantastic.
Brilliant. So one of the things I tried to consider, a rule, if you will, is I wanted my picks, I wanted my homages to be more than just a clever wink. I wanted them to be a riff that ideally would inform how we interpret and understand that scene that we're watching now, the new scene, and maybe it would even recontextualize somehow that original scene. Now, I did set out with this goal. I'm not saying I achieved it with every pick, but it is something I thought about. And my number 5 movie homage is one that came up in a conversation we had as part of a Sacred Cow review in 2016. The great critic Matt Zoller-Seitz was on the show to talk about his Oliver Stone book, The Oliver Stone Experience. We discussed what is, I think, his all-time favorite movie, Born on the 4th of July. And it's the moment during the parade in that opening sequence where we meet young Ron Kovic, who later is played by Tom Cruise, and it's the baton toss in the air during the parade that is a reference to 2001? Kubrick's 2001, A Space Odyssey bone toss. And I love everything about that opening sequence, how evocative it is. It's totally heightened with Ronnie's voiceover, and he's playing with his friends in the woods, and it's all baseball games, and it's this beautiful portrait of small-town American life in that time period, post-World War II. We're well before the sort of loss of innocence of the Vietnam era and Watergate and all those things that we always think about. And he's watching. Young Ronnie is on the shoulders of his dad watching the parade. And there is the moment where there's the drum majorettes, as I think they're called, and one of them throws that baton up in the air. And I mentioned during the review at the time that I got the reference. It's almost impossible to not see it as a reference. But it is missing an element that makes the 2001 cut so special, which is that it's a match cut. Mm. The baton going up in the air and then that syncing up in a way with the movement of that satellite or whatever is in orbit above the Earth. We don't get that kind of match cut here, but I knew it was too blatant to not be deliberate. So what is Oliver Stone going for there? And of course, I did seize on ultimately that there is a common theme. It's this idea of war. It's this idea of violence. We're a lot less vulgar about it now. We're not apes anymore who use that weapon to beat each other. Now, as I said at the time, we couch our passion for violence and for war in pageantry. And that's what we see in this parade. Now, Matt Zoller Seitz, it turns out, said it much more eloquently and much more incisively than I did there. In his book, I just got this out today, he breaks down the shots, and he says this: the mirroring is quite exact. Both sequences are shot in slow motion and cut from a person throwing an object in the air to a close-up of the object tumbling against the sky. In Kubrick's film, the shot of the bone used to kill an enemy hard cuts into an image of an orbital nuclear weapons platform, showing how violence and technological advancement have been intertwined throughout history. The baton toss in Bourne adds a layer to Kubrick's formulation, suggesting that ideology can also be a weapon. So not really how I saw it. I thought he was making more of a direct connection, but I love that idea that Matt gets into there of ideology itself being a weapon in the same way that that bone is used as a weapon at the start of 2001.
I think Born on the 4th of July needed more apes, personally.
Really?
No, not really. But that's such a specific moment, mm-hmm, in 2001. It's just interesting to think about it being recontextualized so thoroughly,
right,
in a different movie. Like, even if there is that thematic resonance,
yeah,
it's such a strange swipe, such a specific swipe.
It is. And I love it. So it's my number five. What about your number four, Tasha?
Well, it was very hard to make this list without evoking Quentin Tarantino in some way, because he is such a quoter of other films.
Yes.
I was actually very tempted with number four to go for the sequence at the beginning of Swingers, where everybody's sitting around a table and talking about Tarantino and how he stole from Scorsese. And somebody says, "Everyone steals from everyone." That's movies. And then the entire sequence is shot like the table sequence from Reservoir Dogs.
Yes.
And then it ends with them all walking out in slow motion.
Yes.
Like Reservoir Dogs.
And the great punchline there, I have to throw in, because I became aware of the ubiquitous cultural understanding that everyone in L.A. drives a car because of the movie Swingers, because of the joke that he's riffing on Reservoir Dogs. And then they not only walk out and just walk out, but we see all of them get into their own individual vehicles.
Their own individual cars.
That little joke.
That line of them.
Yes. Was a nice touch there.
That is a little gag. I was tempted to go with that, but I feel like rather than going with someone quoting Tarantino, I should probably go with Tarantino quoting someone. And for me, of all of the many things he's referenced in his movies, of all of the homages he's built up, I'm not sure that there is one as elaborate as this one, and that is The Hateful Eight, which is pretty much a movie-length quotation of John Carpenter's The Thing. There are some incredible breakdowns of this online, how it starts with shots of the frozen Arctic, how it moves from there into long-distance shots of the contained space where the action will take place, cuts from there to a character playing chess, cuts from there to looking out of a window to see new arrivals, and so forth and so on. Just scene by scene, shot by shot, the way the path to the privy is lined up in Hateful Eight quotes the way that the paths from building to building
are
set up in The Thing. there are so many different specific small references, but this isn't a four-hour podcast. I'll just say
that most of the time.
That's right. I think I was on the last time this was a four-hour podcast. But on a macro scale, they're both about a group of people in isolation, trapped by a storm in a single location, under circumstances that stoke their paranoia. None of them know whether to trust each other or how much. And it's a question of who's going to live and who's going to die, how they're going to survive, how bad it's going to get, and how it's all going to play out.
One of them fellas is not what he says he is.
What is he?
In cahoots with this one, that's what he is. One of them, maybe even two of them, is here to see Domergue goes free.
Are you sure you ain't just being paranoid?
Our best bet is this duplicitous fella ain't as cool a customer as Daisy here. He won't have the leather patience it takes to just sit here. He can't handle it. He'll stop waiting. Try and create his opportunity, and that's when Mr. Jumpy reveals himself.
And what you got to say about all this?
What do I got to say about John Rhys Ravens?
He's absolutely right.
Me and one of them fellows is in cahoots. We're just waiting for everybody to go to sleep. That's what we're gonna kill you.
Ultimately, it comes down to the same ending, where two people who don't trust each other and don't like each other are isolated and alone and facing their death and quietly conversing about it because they have nothing else. Now, the biggest – I don't think it's quite an Easter egg, but sort of the biggest quotation in all of this is that Tarantino found and repurposed tracks that had been composed for Carpenter's The Thing and were never used, and he used them to score The Hateful Eight.
Right.
That is devotion to an homage, my friend.
And not to mention Kurt Russell.
Of course. Well, yeah, it's so obvious.
That's so obvious.
Why even mention it? I mean, I think he probably would have had Kurt Russell in there even without it. But
good point.
Yes, of course. The whole thing is a bit of a Shaggy Dog story about Kurt Russell's survival and what happens to him throughout
story. I love that film, both The Hateful Eight and The Thing. Josh and I talked about The Hateful Eight forever, especially as we got into a bunch of feedback in response to our review, and we disagreed strongly about the movie. And I'm sitting here with my mind blown right now, Tasha, because somehow I haven't seen any of this chatter online. I've never made that connection to The Thing. And it's so obvious.
Once you see it,
it's absurd. It's absurd.
That is one of the great things about a really good homage is there's that moment. There's so many moments in Ready Player One, which of course inspired this list, where you say, oh, there's that thing. Oh, there's that thing. But It's the slow burn, complicated ones where you start to piece it together bit by bit that really have an impact.
Agreed. And while you were talking about it, this is me projecting. It may or may not be the case, but you get the sense from Tarantino and his homages that it's not as if, and maybe he did this precisely, but I don't get the sense watching his films that he sat down with The Thing and went through it frame by frame and tried to match everything up mathematically. I think that film is so ingrained in his psyche that when he's making the movie, I'm not saying he's not being deliberate about it and it's not conscious. It is conscious. And yet he knows that film so well that spacing a shot a certain way, lining something up a certain maneuver, the way the camera moves, the way characters interact with each other. I think he can just recall that so immediately and understands it so well that it flows organically somehow from him.
You know, I couldn't claim to understand Tarantino's brain. I find that interpretation hard to believe because I know that brain is so full of cinematic detritus, essentially, that unless he can like switch tracks like an 8-track player and tune everything else out except the one film he's focused on.
But how many times has he seen The Thing? Like, I don't think he has to watch that again. I think he can just make The Hateful Eight with all of its allusions to it without ever actually directly going back to the material. Well, I just wonder.
I would like to think that's true. What's your number four?
My number four comes from a filmmaker who actually could probably be excluded along with Quentin Tarantino, and that was actually my third rule here. You've hit on all of them now. I did have to leave off any Quentin Tarantino movie. There are just too many good ones and too many good references for me to try to nail it down and come up with just one of them. But another filmmaker whose entire body of work really are references to the filmmakers he loves, Woody Allen. and the final shot of The Purple Rose of Cairo referencing the final shot of Fellini's Knights of Cabiria for me is a major one, and it is my number four. There is a link, and I'll put this in our show notes, to a list over at Criterion.com. It's called Woody Allen Pays Homage To, and it's just a list of the movie that he is referencing and then the movie that he made referencing it. And there's 39 of them there. And honestly, you could probably double that. Scenes from A Marriage being re-envisioned as Husbands and Wives. Smiles of a Summer Night, two Bergman films here, being re-envisioned as a Midsummer Night sex comedy. And there are a lot more, obviously, that aren't Bergman references. There's a great joke in Husbands and Wives referencing Kurosawa's Ron. I don't know if you remember this movie very well, Tasha, but it's where Sidney Pollack's character is now seeing the younger, like, yoga instructor, astrologist, and we see them. Wait,
there's a scene in a Woody Allen movie where an older man is dating a younger
woman. It's shocking. And where the older man is deriding the intelligence of the younger woman.
Oh, dear.
But for us cinephiles, it's a funny joke where she and he are walking out of the theater. It's a long shot. We just see the marquee of the theater. We can barely really see them in the frame, but we hear them and they're arguing about the movie because she apparently didn't get it. And all it says on the marquee is Akira Kurosawa's Ron. And we hear her say, "For your information, Shakespeare didn't speak Japanese."
Oh, no.
So
there are
lots of references like that to the work of great filmmakers in Woody Allen's films. And this one has always been the most powerful for me, maybe because it doesn't in some ways seem to be the most direct or derivative, but is calling on the same power of that previous film. Purple Rose came out in 1985, set in New Jersey during the Great Depression. I think it's 1935. Mia Farrow is in it as Cecilia. She's a waitress. She's in a lousy marriage and really kind of has a lousy job, and her escape is movies. And this movie itself is a larger reference to a bunch of other films, including maybe most notably Buster Keaton's Sherlock Jr. In that film, though, the character goes into the movie world. In The Purple Rose of Cairo, it's a character from the movie world, Tom Baxter, played by Jeff Daniels, who comes out of the movie world and interacts with Cecilia. In Knights of Cabiria, Giulietta Masina plays a prostitute down on her luck in Rome. And I won't spoil where these movies go, even though one is from 1957 and one's from 1985. But I love both films, especially Knights of Cabiria, and encourage anyone to see them if they haven't. Both women are left at the end of the film in very similar unhappy predicaments through very similar circumstances. And you're really watching both these women in these tearful moments, these profoundly unhappy moments, and you're wondering as a viewer, how will either of them ever get over the devastation of what they've experienced? And we see in Knights of Cabiria her walking along the road, and all of a sudden a bunch of young people start passing her. They're playing music, they're dancing, they're singing, they're riding on scooters. It seems almost like a circus all of a sudden just came into town and is going by her. And that little parade prompts her to smile. And the final shot of that film is this close-up of Messina and her smile. Despite how unhappy she is in that moment, some joy of life and joy of performance still manages to put a smile on her face. And for Cecilia, she goes to where she always goes. She goes to the movie theater. She's sitting down instead of walking, but this is her place of refuge, her sanctuary. It's the only place that does bring her that joy. And as she sits there in tears, she finally starts to take note of what's happening on the screen, and it's cheek to cheek from Top Hat, Astaire and Rogers in that scene, and she can't help but get caught up in it, just like Messina does in Cabiria. She just subtly smiles at it through her tears. A different kind of spectacle, but that same close-up shot, the same angle, and that same kind of face getting swept up in that moment. And as I said, I'm a fan of both films, but I'd especially encourage anyone to see the Fellini film from 1957, Knights of Cabiria, if they haven't.
Well, that's really amazing. I have seen both of those films, and I never drew the connection between them.
And I'll say, a lot of people, I Google it, nobody's written about it. It almost makes me think I'm wrong. I've written about it. I wrote about it in grad school. But otherwise, there's not a lot of direct mentions of Cabiria and The Purple Rose of Cairo for some reason. But to me, it's unmistakable, unmistakable, without a doubt, that Woody is referencing that film.
You know, I was obviously very aware that Purple Rose of Cairo is a movie about watching movies, about the experience of movies and what they bring to us emotionally and just sort of about the shape of the cinematic mm-hmm. fantasy. But it never really occurred to me to dig deeper into the specific cinematic fantasies at work there. I mean, Woody Allen is such a cinematic magpie in so many ways. He is, in many ways, he is kind of the highbrow Quentin Tarantino. But it had not occurred to me to look deeper into his films for the specific things he was quoting. And I think that's probably a blind spot on my part.
Okay. We're through two picks. We remind you that good artists copy, great artists steal. Our top five movie homages will continue in a moment. Stay with us.
I believe the children are our future. Teach them well and let them lead the way. Show them all the beauty they possess inside. Give them a sense of pride to make it easier. Let the children's laughter remind us how we used to be. Everybody's searching for a hero. People need someone to look up to. I never found anyone to fulfill my needs. A lonely place to be. So I learned to depend on me. I decided long ago never to walk in anyone's shadow. If I fail, if I succeed.
Oh my god, listen to that sad, sad music as she leaves. It's like boo-hoo. That is actually kind of sad.
Anything you see here we can do, by the way. Get ready to have some fun, okay? Okay. Mary Pat, Mary Kate, Mary Frances, Tova, let's see it. Come on, bring it on.
Just get really happy when they finally let her shop.
What a great pull there, Tasha. A good suggestion by you as we are continuing our top five movie homages, Romy and Michelle's high school reunion.
That is one of my all-time favorite scenes in a movie where a character watches a movie. And it's mostly just for the camaraderie that they show there. It says everything about their characters in the moment where you're trying to figure out who their characters are.
Yeah.
Both what their friendship means to them and how they relate to the world in the exact same way through culture.
That's a great point. It's a great bit of shorthand by the screenwriter and by the director to be able to give us that moment where they know that we have a relationship with that material. We've seen Pretty Woman and we understand it. And so as we see them process that movie and their appreciation for it, we can make certain generalizations, I suppose, about who they are as people, right? And so
very much about who they are and what they value.
Yeah, it's very effective. That's a much better scene than my number three, as both of them are silent. So I don't know what Sam is going to be able to do for clips from those. But before we get to that homage, let's hear your number three.
Well, my number three, coincidentally enough, is about watching movies, about characters watching movies. And it touches on Spielberg and his Ready Player One fascinations, I think, in just the slightest way. He was the producer of Joe Dante's Gremlins, which is a movie which features a bunch of horrible little monsters destroying a town and killing people until they get tired and the sun comes out and they go to a movie theater and sit down and watch Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. And they all joyously sing along with it, even though they don't really speak English. And you get a theater full of nasty little green fangy puppets singing.
Terrified right now.
I'm enjoying.
That was too good.
I'm enjoying the laughter. Well, you know, I've been in that theater. I've sung along with those gremlins. None of this is really true, but just don't feed me after midnight. The scene, I think, just resonates so much because so many movies in which people watch movies are commentaries on some form of the cinematic experience. They're about two people on a date experiencing the same emotional moment, maybe before they're ready to experience that emotional moment in their own relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Or they're about somebody alone in a theater experiencing something that's resonant to their lives. Or in this case, it's about the communal experience. The sequence of the gremlins watching Snow White and the Seven Dwarves is just, it's such a weird, joyous little moment in such a weird, tonally jumpy movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's, I mean, horrible, scary, frightening things happen in this film. But the same horrible little monsters that do these horrible things can be seen to be like children in their appreciation of this film and its moment. So I love the idea. And of course, it also leads to their horrible deaths for the most part. But nonetheless, you can take that moment to say, even horrible little monsters from beyond, from no clear place, mm-hmm. from a complete mystery yeah. of a creature that they emerged from.
Respond to the joy of that.
Still respond to something that's aimed at children and something that kind of touches all of us.
Yeah. Great, great choice. One I certainly wouldn't have thought of. And Gremlins is a classic 80s film. I love it. Josh really loves that movie. It's made previous top fives.
There is actually a gremlin in Ready Player One at one point.
Ah.
It was apparently an Easter egg that the animators snuck in without alerting Steven Spielberg
huh.
that they were pulling this little piece of his cinematic past. He was a producer, obviously, on Gremlins, and the film is kind of closely associated with him tonally. So that was one of a number of references to his past that they snuck in without consulting him.
And now that that's been revealed, that animator has been killed by Spielberg.
No, killed by gremlins, actually. It's a really ironic
so.
Tragedy.
Okay.
What's your number three?
My number three. I mentioned that they are silent scenes, and I'm going with the most winking, clever pick on my list at number three. Another filmmaker who probably could be excluded along with Tarantino because of so many references throughout his filmography, Brian De Palma. Body Double is basically Rear Window. We could come up with probably 50 references to Hitchcock in his movies. This is not Hitchcock. It is maybe the most obvious choice for a movie homage in movies, but that's because it's really, really good. It's a wonderful scene. It's the Odessa Steps reference that comes up in The Untouchables, the scene at Chicago's Union Station with the baby in the carriage going down the stairs as the mom screams in horror and a whole gunfight plays out in slow motion. So this is a reference to Eisenstein's Battleship Potemkin, came out in 1925. On board the boat, the sailors revolt and the people of Odessa come out to support them. And the soldiers that are under the Tsar's regime come out to quell that rebellion. And we see them over this really wondrous sequence and really devastating, terrifying sequence. We see these soldiers mow down these innocent protesters, and there is a scene where we see a child in a carriage, just like the one we see in The Untouchables, going down those steps. We later see a child actually stepped on and killed, and the mother's horror at witnessing that. And even though it's a direct homage, the De Palma scene in The Untouchables couldn't be more different, because, of course, Eisenstein was all about montage and the power of editing to create an emotional effect on the viewer. And here De Palma's taken that revered cinematic moment, that emotional moment, and he's completely slowed it down. He's sort of reversed it. Here he's working in slow motion and really drawing out the sequence. And watching both scenes again today, Tasha, I was thinking, is this one of those great kind of film school references that is really fun to see De Palma riff on, but is it really cynical? The fact that he's taken this hyper-political film and this really scary sequence where we witness horrible oppression of these people, and he seems to appropriate it just because he can. And he turns it into a scene where it's just a cool gunfight, really, on these steps. I think a case could be made by someone, I don't know if it's me, that he's drawing our attention to our capacity for violence in this scene. There is kind of this sense of the mistreatment of our fellow man. The gangsters and the police are so focused on what they're doing that someone like this mom and their child can be caught in the crossfire. There are other bystanders in the scene. The gangsters, of course, are just shooting indiscriminately in this public place because they're so determined to take down Ness. I think, as I said, that's a case that could be made. Someone else makes another argument. Writing for Taste of Cinema, the writer says, this isn't style without substance. Ness is a by-the-book husband and father torn between traditional values and the brutal overreactions necessary to battle Al Capone's mob rule. The further he strays from his moral code, the more people around him suffer. This sequence distills the conflict. His good deed, bringing the pram, the carriage up the steps, blows his cover and puts the mother and child in danger as they end up surrounded by gun-toting villains. So they make a great case. This actually ties into the larger themes of the movie, and referencing that baby carriage heightens this conflict within De Palma's character, Elliot Ness. It's something that I wouldn't have thought of. I was honestly just going with it as a really fun sequence. It's just fun to watch how he plays it out in slow motion.
You know, I've never been the world's biggest Brian De Palma fan.
Me neither.
And
yeah.
I suspect that that's because my early introductions to him were all about the films that he had you can say paid homage to, you can say ripped off or appropriated. I think the line between those two things entirely hinges on whether you appreciate the results or not.
Yeah.
And his converting of Antonioni's blow up into blowout, his converting of Dial M for Murder and Rear Window and Vertigo into body double, mm-hmm. all of these things seem to me to be just kind of stealing from the masters more than paying homage to the
sure.
masters, more than referencing the masters. And in this case, the untouchable scene to me, that baby carriage just always seemed like such a distraction in the middle of a really exciting and engaging scene
uh-huh.
that didn't necessarily need him saying, and by the way,
right.
I know classic cinema.
Right. He can't help himself, though.
No,
he just
no,
can't
he
help
really
himself,
can't.
But it's one I enjoy.
It is interesting that we keep coming back to these magpie referencers, these people who habitually over and over and over visually reference, conceptually reference other mm-hmm. films. To me, the Potemkin steps scene was a slightly better ripped off like 2 years earlier when Terry Gilliam did it in Brazil
mm-hmm.
in the middle of a similarly chaotic scene with a robot rolling down the steps, which he said he did as a goof because he was bored
okay.
on set that day. So,
fair enough.
So not to undermine your number three, but curse you, Brian
but
De Palma.
You did. You're number two.
My number two. It makes me laugh to think of this one. So 1983's Trading Places.
Yes.
Famously hinges on a bet made between two billionaires played by Ralph Bellamy and Don Ameche, who are very callous about human life.
Mortimer and
Randolph.
Randolph.
The Duke brothers. They are the proprietors of Duke & Duke, a very high-placed trading firm. And they make a bet that they can – well, they make a bet, and it's about trading places, and that's the subject of the film. But it catches up Dan Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy in this scheme that is – very much about the callousness of the rich mm-hmm. and the abuses that they rain down upon the poor. By the end of the film, those two men are bankrupt, and it's a great comeuppance. It's the villains get what they deserve, and that's sort of the end of the movie. 5 years later, Eddie Murphy was in a completely different film, Coming to America, and his character is an African prince coming to America, coincidentally enough, and seeing how Americans live. And at one point, he's out walking with a woman he's dating, and he sees a couple of bums lying in a pile
That's
of
right.
trash.
That's right.
Gives one of them a pile of money. And they sit up, and lo and behold, it's Ralph Bellamy and Don Ameche playing those same two uh-huh. characters from 5 years earlier. It feels like the end of a long and involved Shaggy Dog joke. The kind of thing where somebody rambles on and you don't know where they're going, and then eventually there's a
yeah,
payoff.
There's the payoff.
It's completely unexpected because there is no reason to believe that this takes place in the same world. Eddie Murphy is there as a completely different character in a completely different situation. But there are the Duke brothers. They sit up. They reference each other by name, Mortimer and Randolph. And one of them says, "We're back," looking at this huge wad of money he's been gifted. And they run over and thank him. And then they disappear from the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just – it's such a nice bit of completely unexpected, thoroughly random payoff. The fact that they got the two of them back to play those uh-huh. characters, the fact that it was in an Eddie Murphy movie,
yep.
and the fact, of course, that Eddie Murphy is playing such a diametrically opposed, rich, powerful, successful character instead of the struggling striver that he's playing in Trading Places,
mm-hmm.
I think is just a beautiful bit of simultaneously misdirection and parallelism.
I love it.
So Trading Places and Coming to America.
Yeah.
There you go.
Both very, very funny movies.
What about your number
My
two?
My number two is less funny. A lot less funny, actually. A little more serious, but it's another really famous one, and I would say also for very good reason.
Ah, little lad, you're staring at my fingers. Would you like me to tell you the little story of right hand, left hand? The story of good and evil? H-A-T-E. It was with this left hand that old brother Cain struck the blow that laid his brother low. L-O-V-E. You see, these fingers, dear hearts, these fingers has veins that run straight to the soul of man. The right hand, friends, the hand of love. Now watch, and I'll show you the story of life. These fingers, dear hearts, is always a warring and a tugging, one against the other.
The Night of the Hunter, Love versus Hate monologue by the Reverend Harry Powell, Robert Mitchum, being done by Bill Nunn's Radio Raheem in Spike Lee's
Do the Right Thing.
Yeah, and there's a mashup of this on YouTube that's really fun to compare. They are very similar in terms of their overall speeches and the words they're using. Here, Spike Lee has updated the language to some extent. He's made it a little bit more like what Radio Raheem in this scene would actually say. It's a case where Mookie, the character Spike Lee plays in the movie, is out on his deliveries. He runs into Radio Raheem. I haven't seen the movie in a while. I think it's where we're introduced to him as a character. I could be wrong, but I think we're introduced to him as a character. Mookie is standing before him, says, "What's going on?" basically, and he launches into these new brass rings he has, the love versus hate, and he tells the story of love versus hate.
Hey! It was with this hand that Cain iced his brother. Love. These five fingers, they go straight to the soul of man. The right hand, the hand of love. The story of life is this. Static. One hand is always fighting the other hand. And the left hand is kicking much ass. I mean, it looks like the right hand love is finished. But hold on, stop the presses. The right hand's coming back. Yeah, he got the left hand on the ropes now. That's right. Yeah, ooh, it's a devastating right and hate is hurt. He's down. Ooh, ooh, left hand hate KO'd by love.
Like the Reverend Harry Powell, even though Mitchum's character is the main character in The Night of the Hunter, the 1955 Charles Laughton movie, and Radio Raheem's a supporting character, they are inciting characters. A lot of the action that eventually unfolds does revolve around those characters. And in the case of Mitchum, he's got tattoos that say love versus hate. I love some of the differences here in the way Spike Lee does update it, not just with the language, but Reverend Powell is performing his monologue essentially for other people at the shop, including Shelley Winters. Radio Raheem is just performing for Mookie. He's more performing for the audience. He's actually in direct address to the camera. So it's really a speech he's giving for us. And our relationship to the two characters is so different because we really don't know anything about Radio Raheem at this point. But we know everything we need to know about the Reverend Harry Powell by the time he's delivering this scene. The people he's talking to don't. And we know that he really doesn't mean anything of what he's speaking, whereas we have no reason to believe that Radio Raheem doesn't mean everything that he is speaking with conviction. So the difference in their performance is that the Reverend Powell's doing it just to try to convince those people to believe something about him that we know isn't true. But Radio Raheem is... he's actually the one who's spreading a gospel there in that scene, despite the fact that he's not a reverend. And you've got one character who's truly sinister, truly evil, giving this performance. And that movie, if I remember it correctly, does end on a fairly loving note. It ends in a satisfying, happier way. You've got, in Radio Raheem, a more saintly character, a more saintly, loving performance. I don't think you can say the same about how Do the Right Thing ends. So an interesting kind of contrast there with those characters and how those two movies ultimately end. I was Googling today just to see if Spike Lee had ever really spoken on the record about why he referenced that film. And maybe he has before. I didn't come across much other than there was an interview, I want to say GQ some years ago, where they asked him just to name some of his biggest influences. And The Night of the Hunter was the first movie he mentioned. The first movie he said that really influenced him. And he wasn't talking about chronology in terms of it's one he saw first. He just said it's the first movie that came to mind. But I did also come across something at Ain't It Cool News where Moriarty wrote about meeting Spike Lee at a book signing and asking him a question that he'd always wanted to know the answer to. And it was, when Radio Raheem does the love-hate rap, is that Radio Raheem paying tribute to Night of the Hunter, or is that Spike Lee paying tribute to Night of the Hunter? In other words, does the character know that he's referencing that film, or is it just Spike Lee doing it for us? And he said that Spike Lee smiled at the question, and as he thought about it, he took my book and signed it and wrote a short message and then handed it back, his smile growing bigger before he finally answered. Then Spike said, "Radio Raheem ain't never heard of Robert Mitchum." So that's the answer, at least according to the guy who wrote the scene and paid tribute to Night of the Hunter, Spike Lee.
If I love you, I love you. But if I hate you,
there it is, love and hate.
Well, that is a really excellent one. That knuckle tattoo thing has been echoed in so many films and TV shows mm-hmm. over the years, you know, both seriously in something like Cape Fear and in a parodical kind of way. Like what immediately leaps to mind is Sideshow Bob's knuckle tattoos in The Simpsons, where all the characters only have three fingers. So his version is L-U-V and H-A-T uh-huh. with an accent over the A to make it clear it's a long A. So, it's been echoed so many times in so many ways. And I think that's just – it speaks to how well Night of the Hunter speaks to people. Mm-hmm. That sequence where Mitchum lays out the version of the sermon that he has literally had tattooed on his body is so evocative and so hypnotic just because of the way he presents this story as a practiced thing that he yes. knows – he knows will hypnotize people. He knows will convince people of his sincerity. For Radio Raheem, who's just gotten the rings, it's a new thing, but it's something that he's thought through.
Right.
But perhaps it's something that he hasn't been presenting to people over and over.
Exactly.
So that's another sort mm-hmm. of like contrast between them, like the old practiced hand at this and, you know, the guy preaching this new thought that's occurred to him. It's there's so much respect there, I think, in bringing that across. I did run across it sort of while I was researching and thinking about this, and it came close to being on the list. But I think ultimately for me, it was the two scenes are so similar in so many ways. I hadn't thought about the contrast that you bring to them, which does draw more out
sure.
of it.
Yeah.
But I think that's an excellent choice.
Well, thank you. I'd love to hear your number one, Tasha.
Well, for my number one, I really had to go back to the Spielberg well. I mean, if you're going to talk about films quoting other films in contrast to Ready Player One, it's really hard not to come back to Spielberg and one of his favorite filmmakers, John Ford, and one of his favorite films, The Quiet Man. You may, if you've seen this movie, remember a scene where Maureen O'Hara has snuck into John Wayne's house and has been cleaning it. He comes home and catches her up in his arms as she's trying to flee and kisses her in the doorway. Spielberg took that scene and put it in the hands of an 8-year-old in E.T. the Extraterrestrial. There's a sequence where E.T. is home alone, as one is, and is building his little phone, and he sees this scene from The Quiet Man come on the television. And because he and his friend Elliot have a mental link, Elliot starts feeling the emotions of the movie that he's not even watching and acting them out in his school science lab, where he sets all of these frogs free and then sweeps a girl his age, who is therefore much taller, into his arms and kisses her as Spielberg cuts back and forth between the Quiet Man on the TV and Elliot living out the Quiet Man in real life. Once again, this is just a scene that brings out the emotional connection between movies and the people who watch them. Mm-hmm. In this case, the person who's watching it isn't even watching it. The thing that's watching it, the extraterrestrial that's watching it, doesn't have any sort of clear understanding of what he's experiencing, of what the context is. But clearly the emotions come across and are transmitted in some strange, arcane way. And this classic movie is brought to life mm-hmm. in just the weirdest, strangest way. I'm not entirely sure that it works as a scene in E.T. It's a very strange idea, this little boy sweeping up this classmate for a kiss, which to do so he has to stand on another mm-hmm. another classmate to make it happen. But as a quotation of a movie that Spielberg loves, a moment that he loves, an emotion that he loves, there's just something kind of delightfully impish about the whole thing. And I love the literally alien strangeness mm-hmm. of trying to see a piece of classic culture through the eyes of a little literal visitor to our planet.
Right.
So for me, The Quiet Man in E.T., that's my number one.
It's a great pick. Obviously, so perfect for this show as we started by talking about Ready Player One and The Quiet Man, the only film that has come up so far on this show that I haven't seen. So a regret, a real blind spot for me. My number one is, gosh, it's probably another obvious one, but I love it so much. And I think we should actually just hear a little bit of the conversation that happens at the beginning of Robert Altman's The Player. This is Fred Ward.
Pictures they make these days are all MTV. Cut, 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 cut. The opening shot of Welles' Touch of Evil was 6.5 minutes long.
6.5 minutes, Walter?
Three or four anyway. He set up the whole picture with that one tracking shot. My father was
Keep grip on that shoe.
Hey, what about Absolute Beginners, man? That was an extraordinary shot. What
the hell was that? Never heard of it.
It's Julian Temple. It's an English film.
We're in English. We're talking about American movies. Orson Welles was
a master. So Fred Ward, I feel like he's the head of security or something at this movie studio. The beginning of Altman's The Player, dropping some movie history knowledge on a young intern there or something, and he openly references the shot that Altman is openly referencing from the beginning of Orson Welles' Touch of Evil. And I love it that he says it's 6 or 7 minutes long or something like that. And he says, is it really? He says, well, it's 3 or 4 anyway. And it is. It's actually, I believe, 3 minutes and 20 seconds, the Orson Welles opening tracking shot from Touch of Evil. The Player, that opening shot is actually 8 minutes and 5 seconds long. It's insane. But even though it references a couple other famous tracking shots there in the dialogue, clearly it's Touch of Evil that Altman is alluding to, because it's not just a long tracking shot, but there's a moment at the beginning of it where it cranes up in the air and then comes back down. It follows a vehicle at one point, just like the Welles scene ends with an accident, an explosion. Here we've got a mailboy or something on a golf cart who is involved in an accident, a body laying on the floor. And you hear Fred Ward's character say it, that it sets up the whole movie. And it really does. It's an introduction to the characters, some we're not going to see in the rest of the film, and some we are, including Charlton Heston and Janet Lee, the setting, the crime milieu. But thematically, for me, I've always loved the beginning of Touch of Evil, because this is a whole movie about crossing lines, literal lines, or at least definable lines, like a border between the U.S. and Mexico. And that opening shot, we see the camera go across that border. But there are also more abstract lines that the movie deals with, right and wrong, lawful and unlawful. And this camera, Welles's camera, can just pass right through those borders and ultimately expose them, at least expose them for us, the audience. And I just love the playfulness of Altman equating this sunny Hollywood studio set with the corruption and sleaziness of what Welles gave us in that little border town we see in Touch of Evil, and what Hank Quinlan, Welles' character, and Vargas, Charlton Heston's character, all get swept up in. But as we see over the course of that movie, it is that corrupt and sleazy, that movie studio. So it's perfect and it's clever as hell. And I just really love the beginning of both films, Touch of Evil and The Player.
Man, what a perfect choice. It has been way too long since I've seen The Player, and I really need to revisit it. I mean, how perfect, though, is it for a movie that is, it's fundamentally, again, about movie making from the business standpoint, from the experience of people who are sort of struggling in the trenches to try to get films financed and made, for that film to quote such a famous moment from such a successful, like, visually artistic,
right,
successful film, is just kind of a statement up front. I mean, Altman also just kind of a bit of a collector, obviously.
He is.
Very aware of the history of Hollywood, of the history of movies, of classic movies.
Mm-hmm.
That moment specifically, just kind of like bringing in, there's a ballsiness to it. I think some of that same ballsiness is what I see in De Palma, and kind of resent, because it feels like to some degree he's trying to take some of the glory of the classics and take it for himself.
Yeah.
In this case, it just feels so much more like a statement of purpose,
yes,
a statement of intent,
mm-hmm,
and a statement of daring to say, he's not saying, I'm going to take this scene and how amazing it is and smack it onto my own thing.
Right.
He's saying, I'm going to take this thing and how amazing it is and use it as a window into what can be created in this place when things go well. Now you're going to see what happens when they don't go well.
That is so well said. Thank you, Tasha. I'm glad that you appreciate my number one pick and that you added to it. So those are our top 5 movie homages. Do you have any honorable mentions that you'd like to throw out?
Oh, I've got a handful. It was really hard to resist the "you're so weird, you have no idea" moment from Lion King, referencing Reversal of Fortune. It was so hard not
That's
to bring in.
That's a good
in.
One.
It is. It's not as big and thematic.
Klaus von Bülow. Yeah. I was one of the only people, I felt like, in my theater in Newton, Iowa at the time who had to get that reference. Was I just feeling too proud of myself?
Can you feel too proud of yourself?
I don't know. I don't think
reference like
I don't think Reversal of Fortune, despite the Oscar attention it got, was a widely seen movie?
Maybe not widely seen by people who were in the theater for Lion King. I think there were probably a lot of seven-year-olds in that theater that didn't know why the crazy man was laughing.
Exactly.
But that one was too minor. It's like it's a little in-joke rather than some of the big thematic resonance things we've been talking about. The Romy and Michelle thing is one of my favorites of all time. There's a really terrible movie called Omega Man.
Oh, yes.
Starring Charlton Heston. Yet another take on Richard Matheson's I Am Legend, which also gave us the Will Smith movie and many other versions over the years. But there's a scene in that where Charlton Heston, apparently the last living man in a world of vampires, goes into a theater and
Woodstock.
Sits down and shows himself Woodstock.
I know.
Yes. And he is a hardcore Charlton Heston character, a tough, practical-minded man who is managing to survive in a world by himself. Occasionally, he puts on a green velvet dress coat and a frilly pirate shirt and plays chess with a bust. But, nonetheless, he's a pretty practical man. And the idea of him sitting in this theater,
I know,
day after day after day, watching a bunch of naked, muddy hippies listening to rock. And he's seen it so often he can recite along with
us.
And he laughs and he appreciates
his only connection to humanity is Woodstock. And of course, the joke later, knowing what we know about Charlton Heston, having to revel in the counterculture and all those damn dirty hippies on the screen really just adds to it.
It really does. And then there are just little things like, there's just an amazingly long string of Lucas and Spielberg and later J.J. Abrams referencing each other, throwing C-3PO and R2-D2 into the hieroglyphs in Raiders of the Lost Ark, Abrams throwing R2-D2 being blown out into space in Star Trek. There are so many like little visual references that have kind of like cropped up in that circle of reference. There were a lot that were tempting, but in the end, I was happy with this list.
Yeah.
How about you?
I have a few here. Boogie Nights, Paul Thomas Anderson referencing Goodfellas, Martin Scorsese, one of the great referencers as well in his work. But the opening shot, the club going in with that tracking shot, seeming very similar to the Coppa shot in Goodfellas, and the snorting cocaine sequence, there's that shot that's a direct reference to Ray Liotta, where he takes the snort and then it's the extreme close up on his face. There's one just like that with Mark Wahlberg's Dirk Diggler in Boogie Nights. This is maybe a little bit more subtle because it's just a character's name, but the great Robert Mitchum noir Out of the Past, referenced by Jean-Pierre Melville in Le Samurai, Alain Delon's character's name is Jeff, which seems a clear reference anyway to the Jeff character that Mitchum plays in that film. And I think Melville has come out and said that. And then how about more recently, all of the great allusions in Rian Johnson's The Last Jedi. Forrest Wickman and Sam Adams wrote about this over at Slate when the movie came out. And we'll link to that in our show notes if you haven't seen it. But there are a bunch of them. There's a reference to Wings in that opening shot of the casino sequence there. But for me, it's the references to Ron. We touched on these during our discussion of that movie. But the references to Ron during the big finale, the big fight at the end, and there are some other Rashomon touches as well. So the Kurosawa references that happened in The Last Jedi, I really appreciate. And then you touched on it, Robert Altman's The Player was my number one, and The Long Goodbye is one of those films that you almost can't even consider what that Elliot Gould film is, a riff on Philip Marlowe, outside of the context of all of its allusions. The movie that uses the Hooray for Hollywood theme being reappropriated in different ways. It's the only music that we ever hear on the soundtrack, but in different versions. And seeing this new version of Marlowe in this new modern day setting that Altman gives us, it's just a brilliant film that is unto itself an allusion to classic cinema and the hard-boiled detective.
Now, see, you have these so many highbrow history of cinema, thoughtful references. And here, one of the first ones I came across and was tempted to bring in was Richard Dreyfuss at the beginning of Piranha 3D, very clearly playing his character from Jaws and referencing the fact that he's never going back to the ocean again.
Really?
Just before he gets devoured by a shoal of carnivorous piranha.
That's only because I haven't seen Piranha 3D, so I'm just the one who's out of touch, Tasha.
I'd say you're missing out, but
no,
you're missing out on a joke that you can probably see on YouTube.
Right. Those are, again, our top five movie homages, and that is our show. We would love to hear from you. If you have any comments about that top five or otherwise, you can call 312-264-0744 or send us an MP3 file or comment. Our email is feedback@filmspotting.net. At filmspotting.net, you can find 13 years of reviews, interviews, and top fives in the show archives. Also at filmspotting.net, if you go to our Madness page, please be sure to vote in the championship round of Film Spotting Madness. It's Pulp Fiction versus Fargo for Best of the 90s Supremacy. If you haven't already, check out the Film Spotting family of podcasts. You can hear Tasha Robinson all the time on The Next Picture Show. And check out Matt Singer and Allison Wilmore. It's not a threat, Tasha.
It sounds a little like a threat.
That's not how I meant it. Over at Film Spotting SVU. Find both in Apple Podcasts or your preferred podcast app. Out in limited release, opening here in Chicago this weekend, is Chappaquiddick, the story of the fatal 1969 car accident that claimed the life of Ted Kennedy campaign strategist Mary Jo Kopechne. Jason Clarke stars as Kennedy. Outside In, this is a new one from Lynn Shelton, a director I respect quite a bit. It's about an ex-con struggling to readjust to life in his small town who forms a bond with his former high school teacher Edie Falco, and Jay Duplass star in that. In wide release, Blockers, three parents try to stop their daughters from having sex on prom night. It's unclear whether this is a comedy or a horror movie. John Cena and Leslie Mann star. And A Quiet Place, this one definitely horror. A family is forced to live in silence while hiding from creatures that hunt by sound. It's directed by and co-starring John Krasinski along with Emily Blunt. Tasha, at this point, as we tape, have you seen any of those films?
Oh, I've seen A Quiet Place, and I liked it a lot.
A lot?
Very much looking forward to your discussion of it.
Okay. Can't wait to do that with Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune next week on the show. We will also discuss the final movie in our Vincent Minnelli marathon, 1958's Some Came Running. Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, and Shirley MacLaine star in that. Tasha Robinson, thank you so much for filling in for Josh and being a delight as always. This was fun.
It's always a pleasure keeping this chair warm.
Where can people find more of your work?
People can find me at TheVerge.com, where I'm the film and TV editor, and I frequently write about film and, coincidentally enough, TV. You can find me at The Next Picture Show podcast, which you've done an excellent job of selling. And you can find me on Twitter at Tasha Robinson.
Thank you again. Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Our production assistant is Andy Mitchell. Thanks to Andy and to Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. Special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. Music this week came from The Blow from their album Brand New Abyss. More info at TheBlow.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.